January 1st, 2025, the last outlaw, his New Year's resolution is that I want to become the AEW World Heavyweight Champion.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home!
I like fighting a woman.
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
I have the best moveset.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 895, Solo Monster Sounds Off, for Sunday, January 5th, 2025. This is the first podcast of what will be my 18th year doing this show, the first sound off of the new year. I am the Solo Monster. Thank you guys for making it another great Make It Till Midnight stream on New Year's Eve. You guys killed it. We had a lot of fun. And now begins a new year. And it has already been a very busy weekend. The reason this show is going up a little on the later side is because in the last few hours, I finally finished watching Wrestle Kingdom and Wrestle Dynasty. Had to do them back to back. And we're going to talk a lot about those two shows because a lot happened. And then we'll get into the news of the week in WWE and AEW and take some questions at the end. So let's get into it here. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. And for more information on anyone who wants to promote a show or a service or anything of that nature, just reach out to me and we'll discuss. Want to say thank you to Francisco in Costa Rica. Thank you, my friend. And yes, let's go Mets. Big B, Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, Josh, the Shooter Stockton, who turns 30 years old today. Happy birthday, Josh. Want to give a shout out to Oscar, the Uffman Fernandez. You may know Oscar as a mod from the YouTube channel or in the Facebook group. He and his wife, Jenny, are celebrating 6 years of wedded bliss today. And they were off to dinner together, and then they were planning on listening to the latest sound, though. You're getting it a little late in the day, but hopefully they're listening to it right now. And yes, even after the last 6 years, he says, she is still a sound-off girl. See, that's a girl worth hanging on to. Congrats to both of you. I hope you have a wonderful anniversary, and here is to 6 more times 10. Better than Raw, Robert Michalshak, Happy New Year. He says, PWG has all but made it official that they are done. They no longer sell their DVDs. They have deleted most of their content on their website. What are your favorite memories, matches, and moments of PWG? You know, I didn't watch a whole lot of PWG, so I don't have a ton of moments to share. One match I did see that stands out to me still is the ladder match with Kevin Steen and El Generico. I believe this one came after their ladder war in Ring of Honor. I don't remember what year it's from, but it was for the PWG title. And they just took some insane bumps in that match. But I remember Generico, when he pulled the title down, you know, because it was hanging from a ceiling grate, I remember him pulling the entire grate down with the title. That stands out to me, maybe more than any other moment from that match. So if I had to give you one, that's the one I would go with. I wish I had more to share. Show Your Role. Chris Ludek, he posted a special one-off video on his YouTube channel covering the top 10 closing moments in Monday Night Raw history. Not matches, closing segments. Search for Chris Ludek on YouTube or for his usual series, What Could Have Been in Wrestling. You check that out as well. All the other content that he's got up there. See, I'm partial to the old Stone Cold, marching down to the ring and stunning everybody before the Invasion pay-per-view. See, that was a badass moment. But Kane's return in 2000 with Paul Bearer is a great one, too. See, Kane wasn't the only one on fire back then. The crowds were, too. And one more shout-out to the guitar hero himself, John Kiernan, who hosts the Ropes and Riffs podcast. He's a wrestling theme song composer, professional musician of over 10 years. And he is giving you stories and interviews with some of your favorite wrestlers and musicians. Some recent interviews include Mercedes Martinez, Dijak, Lince Dorado, Mega Ran, and It Lives, It Breeds, who did Will Ospreay's theme. Check out their episode with Kevin from It Lives, It Breeds, talking about singing Separate Ways with Ospreay on the Jericho Cruise and how he wants to play him out to the ring live one day. Listen to Ropes and Riffs anywhere you listen to podcasts, but the best place is going to be on YouTube if you want audio and video. And then, of course, you could visit Ropes and Riffs, all one word, letter N. Ropes and Riffs on YouTube. Check out Ropes and Riffs on Instagram, X, TikTok, and Facebook, all with the handle at Ropes and Riffs. It is that time of year again. It is time for our annual Royal Rumble Facebook pool in the Facebook group. Shout out to Julian Cannon for once again taking the reins on this. It is completely free to enter. And this year, beyond just the bragging rights that you get, the ultimate Rumble pool winners at the very end, so one for the men's Rumble and one for the women's, will each receive a copy of WWE 2K25 when it is released. So if you want to get in on this, here's how to enter. If you are not in the group, you will need to apply to be approved for membership. If you are in the group, you're going to find Julian's post pinned to the top of the page. You don't have to leave a comment. You can, but you don't have to. All you need to do is like the post, and you're in. That's it. Julian will then be assigning random entry numbers. He's going to post the finalized pools in the group on the Friday before the Rumble. The number that you are assigned is going to represent the entry spot for both the men's and the women's Rumble matches. So, for example, if you have number 15, and the men's Rumble winner entered at number 15, then you would win your pool. So at least one superstar entering at your assigned number must win their respective Rumble. If you win, you get bragging rights for that. Congratulations. But then it comes to me. And what I do is I will take all of those pool winners, however many there may be, and I will enter them into an online randomizer during one of my live streams on YouTube, and that will decide the ultimate Rumble pool winners for 2025. So the deadline to enter is January 30th, so you've got some time, but don't wait. Go find the post and like it. Just remember, it's all in good fun. Don't take it too seriously. This is a spoiler warning for anybody who has not yet watched either of the New Japan shows. If you do not want to be spoiled, because I'm going to be getting into results and details about things that happened on both of these shows, this is your warning. So you can go watch those shows and then come back to the podcast if you don't want to be spoiled, but just be forewarned. From this point forward, this is a spoiler zone. This was New Japan's biggest weekend of the year, with back-to-back shows at the Tokyo Dome, Wrestle Kingdom, and the first ever Wrestle Dynasty, basically their version of Forbidden Door. Usually Wrestle Kingdom is good for a couple of early match of the year candidates, but none of these matches are making my list at the end of the year. Not from night one. I thought overall it was a good show, but it was definitely one of the weaker Wrestle Kingdoms I've ever seen. I don't know what the consensus is on that main event with Zack Sabre Jr. and Shota Umino. I was not a big fan of it. One thing that was clear, though, is that they kept all the other matches in the card shorter. I think specifically to give the main event as much time as possible and maybe to make it feel more special, more main event-like. But I would have much preferred some of the other matches get more time and cut down the 44 minutes that they gave those two by at least 10 minutes. That match did not need to be that long. There have been long Wrestle Kingdom main events that felt like classics when they were over. This was not one of them. Now, there was an unfortunate injury early in one of the matches that probably opened up an extra, I don't know, 12 to 15 minutes maybe. So I don't know how they delegated that extra time. Maybe they gave it to the main event. I don't know. But I just thought that match was excruciatingly long. Last year, Hiroshi Tanahashi, he said that he wanted to sell out the Tokyo Dome this year because the show fell on a Saturday. Usually it falls on a Thursday. The last time they came anywhere close to that, though, you'd have to go back 7 years. They did 43,000 fans in the Tokyo Dome. Last year, they did 27,000. This year, they announced the attendance as 24,107. So Tanahashi did not get the sellout that he was hoping for, not even close. Walker Stewart and Chris Charlton, they were back on the call. You know, I put over Walker last year. That was his first one after replacing Kevin Kelly as their lead English announcer. Easy to forget, he's only 22 years old. And I'll put him over again. I think he does a very good job. Chris was fine in his role of filling in the background on certain guys and their stories. The way he kept referring to Wrestle Dynasty as Wrestle Dynasty, that cracked me up. The New Japan Ranbow, that got over half an hour, but that was on the pre-show. And this year, instead of the winner challenging for the King of Pro Wrestling Championship, which has been retired by the Great Okan, the winner would receive a future shot at the IWGP World Heavyweight title. So they upped the stakes here, which is good. But no major surprises. Great Okan entered first, nearly went the distance, so he was the Iron Man in this. Kenta was in this. We've got him coming back to House of Glory in a few weeks. Satoshi Kojima was out there, the reigning MLW World Champion. Sonata. What a fall for Sonata from where he was. I mean, they tried with him, but it just didn't work. Tomohiro Ishii was in there. In the end, it was Hirooki Goto as the last man standing with the contract for a future IWGP title match. I mean, he's not going to win the title, but I mean, good for him, I guess. This didn't have a lot of the silliness that the matches had in the past. What was it last year? Was it Yo who was out there in track pants and socks, and then somehow he ended up with no socks? This year, they had a more serious prize at the end, so they treated it at least a little more seriously. Doesn't mean it was any good, because it really wasn't. But you kind of know what to expect when it comes to the Rainbow. They had a Tokyo Terror ladder match, which was the first ever ladder match in Tokyo Dome history, pitting the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Kushida and Kevin Knight, in a four-way against Robbie Eagles and Kosei Fujita, TJP and Francesco Akira, and Clark Connors and Drilla Maloney. Drilla Maloney was either on the receiving end of a lot of sloppy shit or doling it out himself a few times. There was one spot on the outside where he was supposed to put somebody through a table that was propped up against the guardrail outside. He got a running start with the guy, and somehow he completely whiffed. I still don't know exactly what happened on that spot. I think he just came up short. I didn't think he looked very good at all in this match. Now, physically, he's put together, you know, more so than anybody else in the match, but he did not look good out there. This was your typical ladder match, car crash match, you know, with the big spots where guys just go out there and kill each other. I'm looking forward to seeing what Cody Rhodes and Kevin Owens do with theirs at the Royal Rumble, because it's one-on-one, and it's been a while since we've had a great ladder match at the Rumble, but even, you know, the Money in the Bank matches or those Face of the Revolution ladder matches that AEW does, I'm kind of over it at this point. You know, there's just the sameness to them all. And now New Japan is doing it. No! No! I don't want to see this. My guess is they were trying to fit as many people on the show as they could, and that's why they turned this into a four-way. That doesn't mean it had to be a ladder match, though. Eagles and Fujita, they won the Super Junior Tag League, so it would have made more sense to just have them challenging for the titles. They did end up winning them. You know, for a four-way ladder match, they only got 13 minutes, and you could tell because they were working this at warp speed. So I was not a fan of this, but I'll tell you what I was a fan of, and they also worked at warp speed, but I thought this was excellent. One of my favorite things on the entire show was the IWGP Women's Championship match with Mayu Iwatani defending against Azumi. Apparently, Iwatani has had Azumi's number for years. Azumi finally got a win over her, though, last year. I think it was back in the summer. They had their Grand Prix tournament. And that's how we ended up here. These two ladies, they beat the crap out of each other right from the opening bell. And it felt like this wasn't going to go very long just based on the pace that they were working. And it didn't. They gave them less than 10 minutes. I think it was right around 9. One of the best 9-minute matches you could ask for. But yet again, the women's title gets shortchanged at the Tokyo Dome, just like it did 2 years ago. Remember, Kairi was the champion. And Kairi Sane, she defended the title and they gave her 5 minutes. Last year, they didn't even have a women's title defense on this show. Disrespected yet again. But they made the most of those 9 minutes. The selling left a lot to be desired, considering some of the moves they were hitting each other with, dropping each other on their heads. And then it was right back up, but they didn't have a lot of time to sell all those moves. And clearly they were trying to make the most of the time they did have, which they did. I thought this was great. Then we had another 4-way match. This one for the New Japan television title, which remains one of the ugliest looking belts in all of wrestling. With Ren Narita defending against Jeff Cobb, Ryohei Ueyawa, and the returning El Fantasma, who is now cancer free, for those who don't know. And they gave him the feel-good win here, too. Ueyawa recently returned from Pro Wrestling Noah. He was on excursion. Ueyawa impressed me here. I thought he looked good. I don't know what he looked like in the ring before he went to Noah, but the excursion did him well. Apparently, he was trained there by Kaito Kiyomiya and Yoshinari Ogawa, who was Zack Sabre Jr.'s mentor. He's one of the men who helped train him. And in one of Ueyawa's first training sessions with him, Ogawa blasted him for how he took bumps in the ring, and he made him relearn everything that he had been taught previously. He was bumping fine here. So whatever he learned there, just stick with that. Cobb looked good too. I thought Cobb was probably the star of the match, but El Fantasma wins the title by pinning Narita, so at least he got, you know, a pin on the actual champion. And I thought this was a lot of fun. Fun, though, is not a word I would use to associate with this next man. It was evil against the ace of New Japan, El Presidente, kicking off his final year in the ring. It could have been his final night in the ring if he had lost this match. Hiroshi Tanahashi. This was a lumberjack match with Tanahashi's career on the line. I love how on commentary they talk about how Tanahashi has vowed to rid New Japan of the House of Torture faction because nobody likes them. And everybody wishes they weren't in the company. You know they're talking about the other wrestlers because, you know, the House of Torture guys are constantly interfering in people's matches. But you know a lot of fans feel the same way. I am always blown away when I have people telling me or I read that they're actually super over. They sell a lot of merch. I don't understand it. I don't get it. Here, they're acknowledging it. They're acknowledging the fact that nobody likes them and everybody wants them out of the company, but in a kayfabe way, even though I think there's a lot of reality in that. I will give praise to Evil for one thing, though. His entrance was awesome. They had this organ player on stage leading into, it was almost like a synthwave type of theme song. I don't know if that's new or not, but I thought that was cool. Lots of cheating and referee bumps and interference in this one. I thought this was the shits, which is sad, but you know, for Tanahashi at this point, a lot of it just depends on who he's in the ring with. And with the right opponent, I think he could still go out there and have a really good match. This one was more about the drama of Evil potentially ending his career early, which was never going to happen. All the lumberjack nonsense gave it the smoke and the mirrors that it needed. Evil hits his everything is Evil finish. He's got the match won. He goes for the pin. But Tanahashi, the crafty veteran that he is, pulls him into a flash pin, and he gets the win. So his career continues. The real surprise came after the match. Katsuyori Shibata ran in wearing an AEW hoodie to make the save when the House of Torture attacked Tanahashi, and he ran them off. Then he got on the microphone, and he challenged Tanahashi to a match the next night at Wrestle Dynasty if he was up for it. And Tanahashi accepted. That was cool. The last time Shibata worked any kind of a match in a New Japan ring, and I'm not talking about the Forbidden Door shows because those really are AEW shows, but it was Wrestle Kingdom 3 years ago, and if you remember, he supposedly called an audible on the microphone out in the ring right before the match where he changed what was supposed to be a catch wrestling rules match with no strikes allowed. That was against Ren Narita. He changed it on the fly to a full-blown regular wrestling match, and they went like, whatever it was, 12, 15 minutes. And they were furious with him over it. Apparently in the back, they were freaking out. This is not supposed to happen. They did not want him out there wrestling a wrestling match. This man almost died on their watch. He had a brain bleed. He had to have brain surgery. I mean, according to Meltzer, they had to remove his brain from his skull for the operation. So him being back to challenge Tanahashi to what I thought was going to be a wrestling match was a big deal. Of course, we would come to find out later on that was not the case, but I'll talk about that when I get to Wrestle Dynasty. We had Shingo Takagi against Kenosuke Takeshita, title for title for Shingo's never open weight title and Takeshita's AEW International title. This is the match I was most looking forward to on this show, and it was excellent. I wouldn't say it quite met my expectations coming into it, but I enjoyed this one a lot. It just never reached that level of greatness that I was hoping for. But it was hard-hitting, and you had Takeshita winning the NEVER title, which means that he would move on then to defend both belts against Ishii the next night. El Desperado challenged Doki for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. Desperado lost the belt to Doki in July, and I had Despy winning it back here, but not like this. They were barely 5 minutes into the match when Doki came off the top rope to the floor, his bombs away senton to Desperado, who was up against the guardrail. He had nowhere to go. The spot itself looked fine, only the way that Doki landed when he put his left arm out to brace his fall, it looked like the arm snapped. And he immediately grabbed at his elbow, which looked gnarly, and the referee called for the stoppage. Tokyo Sports is saying that it is not a broken arm, but it is a dislocated elbow, which doesn't sound any less painful. Although the good news, I guess, is that probably means he won't be out for as long as he would have been if he did break the arm. But it looked nasty, and I felt bad for the guy. You know, their biggest star in the junior heavyweight division, in the biggest match of his life, he finally got himself a big singles match at the Tokyo Dome. Even coming out, he had a superstar entrance. They had this guy, I think he's a known actor. I don't have his name, but this guy's out there in a kabuki getup. He's painted all white. And it's just really cool stuff. It was a really cool entrance, only for it to end the way that it did on a spot that I'm sure he's done a million times before. And so Desperado took the micro. You could tell he was obviously very upset. He took the microphone and cut a short promo at the end of the match and basically said that they'll do it again, you know, down the road. And that's how that ended. David Finlay, he defended the IWGP Global Championship against Yota Tsuji. Finlay impressed me here, you know, with his power, the way he was launching Tsuji around the ring. He doesn't look it, but he's a strong dude. He showed that the next night against Brody King, too. Tsuji won the title in a really good match. This is a year after he made his Tokyo Dome debut. He seems to be well on his way. He is definitely one of their biggest rising stars. And he has a star quality about him that I don't see it yet with Shota Umino, who got the main event spot on this show. Tsuji has that. He definitely has that quality to him. The co-main event was Tetsuya Naito against his protege and now tag team partner as well, Hiromu Takahashi. This was not good. Now, I mentioned in my preview last week when I ran down the card that Naito just underwent his fourth eye operation, the first one he has had on his left eye. He had already had three surgeries on the right eye, and that's the maximum number that he can have. He can no longer have any more surgeries on that eye, because they told him you can have up to three. So it probably would be best to spread them out, but his issues were such that he has now exhausted all three of those. He had the surgery on his left eye because of the macular degeneration that he has in the right one, and he could only see straight if he shut one eye because they were imbalanced. So he had surgery on the left eye to try to balance it out. Now think about that. He had surgery on his left eye to actually make the eye worse on purpose, just to give it more balance with the other one. So this was the teacher against the student. It was a match that Hiromu has wanted for a very long time and almost got it 5 years ago before the pandemic shut everything down. And Naito's body was breaking down then. Now it's 5 years later, and this man is just in shambles. Naito wins after multiple Destinos. I may be in the minority on this. Again, I haven't taken the temperature of everybody else. I've barely had enough time to get through these shows before I hit record on this show. I may be in the minority on this. I was just bored. I'm not even saying it was a terrible match, but it wasn't that good. And it's sad to see the state that Naito is in. And yet, he remains one of their biggest draws. Apparently, there were tons of people there wearing LIJ gear and, you know, dressed up as Naito. And, you know, the 24,000 people they had in the Tokyo Dome, if Naito is not on that card, there's a chance maybe they don't get 24,000 people into that building. He is still one of their biggest draws, if not maybe their biggest draw. You know, in the absence of all the people that have left, Okada being the biggest one, it falls on Naito still. So he is still a very important part of that company. He just can't go anywhere near at the level that he used to. And it's not just his eyes, you know, it's his knees. It's everything. He can't do it. He and Hiromu being a team is probably for the best at this point because it'll lighten the load for him. So I wanted to like this. You can't force yourself to like something, though. You either like it or it's like people. There are people. There are girlfriends you might have. You really want to like them, but you can't force yourself to like someone or something that you really don't. And I just couldn't bring myself to get excited about anything they were doing here. This was a slog to sit through. The main event was Shota Umino challenging Zack Sabre Jr. for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship. With father and son sharing the ring together, the referee, Red Shoes Uno, and his son, even in kayfabe, how is this allowed? How is that fair? Having your father as the referee for your big championship match. How is that not a conflict of interest? This was the first Tokyo Dome show since 2010 without Okada, Tanahashi, or Naito in the main event. So you could feel it's a changing of the guard right now, but it's a changing of the guard that it feels like they had to be dragged into kicking and screaming. You know, it's a changing of the guard that really should have started a few years ago, and they're kind of behind the eight ball. But it does feel like a changing of the guard. We had some history made here as well. Zack Sabre Jr. becomes the first Gaijin star ever to come into the Wrestle Kingdom main event as a champion and leave as a champion. Now, I said coming into this that this was the weakest Wrestle Kingdom main event in years. And it was. This did nothing to change my mind. Sabre won the G1 last year. He only took two losses in his block. One of those came at the hands of Shota Umino. Okay? In the biggest spot of his life. My biggest gripe with this match is that it did not need to go 44 minutes. One of the longest matches in Tokyo Dome history, and it felt like it. Did it have, you know, the ring psychology and the working of the body parts? Yes. Yes, they took their time with that. Shota's selling left something to be desired, but, you know, they tried to tell a story by working certain limbs. The real story here was their efforts to continue to push Shota Umino as a super babyface. Even as the fans rebel against him more and more. Okay, those were the parts of the match that I found to be the most interesting. There was one point where he hit a DDT on the floor outside. And this was early on, probably the first 10 minutes or so. And he got booed. And it only got worse from there for him. Even though he showed that fighting spirit, he kept kicking out of big moves. He wouldn't back down. He was, you know, working his way out of sticky situations. And the more he did that, the louder the boos became. Now, there were flashes of his heelish side here. Like, I was looking at his mannerisms and his facial expressions. I like that. And I am sure there is a heel turn for him in the not-too-distant future. I mean, you saw flashes of it here. The part where Sabre rolled out onto the ring apron, he's laying face down. Umino comes over. He starts stomping on him. Violently. Like a dick. And it reminded me of when Kota Ibushi would end up in a trance and he would start kicking the shit out of his opponent. He looked terrifying. He looked like a fucking serial killer out there. That's what this reminded me of a little bit. And when Red Shoes comes over to try to break things up, he shoves his father down to the mat, which only got him even more heat. So in the end, though, Sabre retains the title. after a Gotch-style pile driver and then a third Zach driver. It never felt like an epic Tokyo Dome main event, but I think it was the kind of match that Umino needed to build him for the future, for where he appears to be headed. It was almost like a split personality thing with him here. This is going to feed into the eventual heel turn that hopefully takes him to that next level, which is where they need him to be. Boy, do they need him to get there. So there were flashes of greatness here and there. Some matches are long and they don't feel long. Others are long and you feel every minute of it. This falls into the latter category. You know, look, some of the greatest matches of all time are under 25 minutes. Had they told the story that they did in, let's say, 30-ish minutes and condensed it down a little bit, I'm not saying I would have sat here and told you, oh my God, this was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I do think it would have helped. So overall, I enjoyed the show, maybe not at the level I've enjoyed past Wrestle Kingdoms, but there was enough there for me to like. Plenty of title changes up and down the card, 5 of them. So it was a newsworthy show, that plus the Doki injury. But the next night, it was Wrestle Dynasty. Now, I just wrapped up the show right before I started recording. There's always a drop-off in attendance for the second night. January 4th is the tradition. January 5th is not. But it was still sad to see the Tokyo Dome so empty for this show. They were down to 16,300 people as the announced attendance, down from the 24,000 they had the night before. And no matter how you want to spin it, that's a terrible number. And Takaki Kidani, the CEO of Bushiroad, which owns New Japan, would agree with me. He expressed disappointment in the attendance numbers to Tokyo Sports and set a goal of 40,000 for January 4th next year. I think with Tanahashi's retirement match, they should do better than they did this year, but 40,000 is going to be a tough hill to climb. He said it might be better to hold another joint show with AEW in Japan, but not so close to January 4th. It didn't help that for a joint event, AEW did a piss-poor job of promoting this show. But see, the thing is, though, I don't think AEW promoting the event better would have made much of a difference as far as the Tokyo Dome attendance. Now, it might have made a difference as far as, you know, subscriptions on New Japan World, pay-per-view buys, overall interest in the show. But Tokyo Dome attendance, I think, would have been relatively unaffected by that. If they're going to do this again, they need to do a better job of promoting at least a couple of big matches with a story or some kind of personal issue behind it. Gabe Kidd, he tried. You know, leading into the match with Kenny Omega, he tried. And on commentary during the show, Chris Charlton, he was going in hard on Tony Khan and AEW. And I see he's getting some shit for it now online. People don't seem to really understand that he was working. They think he was really shooting on AEW, I guess. If we had more of that sort of thing, you know, in advance, maybe that would have helped. But for the most part, it was just a collection of matches pitting one promotion against the other with nothing behind it. We even had some matches coming into the show up until 24 hours beforehand. We didn't even know what some of the matches were going to be because they were dictated by the outcomes on night one. So you had that too. But when you have a main event of Zack Sabre Jr. against Ricochet, while they may both be great wrestlers, that is not a marquee main event, okay? Ricochet in the main event of the Tokyo Dome is not going to do it. I'm sorry. But on the bright side, this was easily the better of the two shows. On the pre-show, we had two matches. First, the four-way for the International Women's Cup, with Willow Nightingale representing AEW, Athena representing Ring of Honor, Persephone representing CMLL, and Momo Watanabe representing Stardom. And she had another Stardom star in Thekla with her in her corner. This was really good stuff. It was not helped by the crowd at all. Athena hit the O-face late in the match on Willow. This might have been the best fucking O-face I've ever seen her hit in my life. Hit it on Willow, had the pin. Thekla, though, pulled the referee out of the ring before the referee could count three. And this is now leading to a match between Athena and Thekla in Japan next week, I think on the 13th. Watanabe hit Athena with a baseball bat. Talk about escalating this from a 0 to 60. A fucking baseball bat hits her in the fucking face with it. while the referee is distracted, and then followed up with a suplex into a bridge and got the three count. Now, in my predictions, I had Momo or Persephone winning this, but I was surprised that Athena was the one to take the losing fall. I presume this now leads to a Momo match with Athena, because she gets to choose now which title she wants to challenge for. You know, it could be the Ring of Honor women's title, the AEW women's title, the IWGP, whatever title. Or maybe not IWGP. I don't know. Maybe it's relegated just to the titles that were represented in this match. I don't know. But she has her choice. My guess is she's going to pick Athena, and we're going to get a Ring of Honor women's world title match, and Athena will get her win back. So the crowd heard this. I thought the match, though, was very good. I enjoyed it. We had Dustin Rhodes and Sammy Guevara in the other pre-show match, defending their Ring of Honor tag team titles against Sho and Yoshinobu Kanemaru, representing the House of Torture. This was Dustin's first match in the Tokyo Dome since 1993, and his first in Japan since 2010. Kanemaru, he spit whiskey in Dustin's eyes late in the match. Dustin came back with a destroyer, then he took a swig of the whiskey, and he spit it in Kanemaru's face. And then Sammy hit a giant senton, and Dustin got the pin to retain the titles. Dustin has been clean and sober for 15 years. I sure hope it was iced tea in that bottle. But this was a solid match. Otherwise, it was a solid match. The main card opened with a lucha gauntlet with mystery entrance. And they worked it exactly like the AEW casino gauntlet matches, which means we're getting two of them in a three-day time span because they're doing one on Dynamite this week. Echicero and Kosei Fujita, they were the first two in. Soberano Jr. was in next, repping CMLL. I should mention the intervals here were only about a minute, so there was not a whole lot happening in between people being called out. Plus, it didn't help that fucking ramp is so damn long in the Tokyo Dome. By the time one guy would get down to the ring, the other one was already coming out. Master Wato was in next. They had Taiji Ishimori was in, then Titan. Last guy in was El Desperado. And since El Desperado is the brand new junior heavyweight champion, all seven other guys, as he's still making his way down the ramp to come out, they're all standing in the ring next to each other, and they're looking at Desperado. And Desperado's like, wait, what the fuck? And they all leave the ring, and they attack him on the ramp. It looked like a gang attack. And then in the ring, they bring him to the ring, and then in the ring, they took turns hitting their finishes on him. I thought this was hilarious. Fujita tried a submission on Desperado, but Ishimori threw the referee into them to break it up, and then he ended up pinning Desperado with a cradle, so effectively stealing the win. I thought this was fun for what it was. You know, when you hear Lucha Gauntlet, you pretty much know it's going to be a spot fest. And as spot fests go, it was a good one. We had Hiroshi Tanahashi against Katsuyori Shibata. I don't think it was made clear the night before that this was going to be a five-minute exhibition with no strikes allowed. Now, forgive me if it was mentioned that I missed it, but I don't believe it was. So this was the first I was hearing of this being a fucking exhibition. And when I heard that, I mean, that was a letdown. But if you like chop fests, then this was the match for you, because that's pretty much all this was. Until Tanahashi gave Shibata a fucking headbutt to the guy who almost died from a headbutt, which is the entire reason, by the way, they will not clear him to do a regular wrestling match. Yet it was Tanahashi, the president of the company, out there giving him a headbutt. Make it make sense. I'm begging somebody, please. They went the full 5 minutes, no winner, and then they raised each other's hands afterwards and paid respect to each other. It's bizarre that we are so accustomed to seeing Shibata wrestling regular matches in AEW and in Ring of Honor all the time, but New Japan still won't let him do one. And you got Tanahashi out there giving him a headbutt. Let's not forget about that. We had Mercedes Moné against Mina Shirakawa. This was a double champion match with both titles on the line. In the case of Mercedes, she was defending not her TBS title, which she was wearing to the ring, but her New Japan Strong Women's Championship. Mina was defending her Rev Pro British Women's title. This was another in a line of very good Mercedes matches going back to November. The first one with Chris Statlander. Then she had the one against Hazuki. And then the rematch with Statlander at World's End. And now this one. This one was not as good as those, but it was still a good match. Like the first women's match on the pre-show, though, I thought the crowd heard it. Mercedes, to the surprise of absolutely no one, I'm sure, wins and becomes the belt collector. Now she has four title belts. I saw her standing there with four belts. For the life of me, I couldn't figure out what that fourth one was. I had to go online to look it up. It is the Queen of Southside title. Southside Wrestling was a promotion, I guess, out of the UK that closed down some time ago. When it did, Rev Pro acquired all of their titles. So I guess it's essentially unified with their British title, which is what Mercedes won here. So she gets to carry both belts with her now for a total of four. She could barely hold all of them up when the match was over. She offered a handshake to Mina after the match. Mina slapped her hand away and screamed, "One more." So I guess we're getting a rematch, probably in the UK, because look, if I'm the promoter for RevPro, I want to get at least one Mercedes Moné match that I could promote and sell tickets for, okay? So that's what I'm thinking. You want to hold the RevPro title, that's great. You could have our belt, but we got to get you in here for at least one show. We had David Finlay against Brody King. This match was basically Brody King just killing this dude for minutes on end. And Finlay, you know, he would fight back, and then Brody would just cut him off and kill him again. And for the finish, Finlay hit a giant powerbomb and then pinned him after hitting his finishing move. And again, the way he powerbombed him, the way that he was, throwing him around and stuff, not unlike his match with Yota Tsuji the night before, was very impressive here. Because you look at David Finlay, it's not like he's a body guy. It's not like you look at him and go, oh, what a powerhouse, fucking Hercules Hernandez out there. But he is deceptively strong. So he found a way to win. I thought the action was good. It was weird because it didn't have a lot of heat. Finlay is a heel. Brody King, I guess, basically is a heel also. But Finlay was in the role of babyface here, trying to make a comeback on the larger, scary man who probably took 75% of the match, and then Finlay just won. And the right man won. I mean, Finlay needed a bounce back win here, and he got one. It was just a very weird dynamic to the whole thing. Then we had Claudio Castagnoli against Shota Umino, the loser of the main event just the night before. Claudio jumped him on the ramp. He beat the hell out of him all over ringside, over the barricade, into the area where the announcers were. The crowd was definitely a little more into Shota on this show than they were the night before. They were kinder to him here than they were in the main event. On night one, Claudio gave him a giant swing at one point during the match. He put Umino in a sharpshooter. Umino got the ropes, though, for the break. Claudio hit the Ricola bomb, but Shota kicked out. And they went back and forth before Shota hit the John Moxley-esque Death Rider, his mentor, and he got the win. It was a good match, very similar to the previous match, in that Claudio took the majority of it, and then Shota made a comeback and just won. But again, it's a win that he needed coming off that loss the night before. Then we had Konosuke Takeshita defending both his AEW International title and his brand new Never Openweight Championship against the Stone Pitbull, Tomohiro Ishii. Crowd was into this right from the opening bell, so was I. This was awesome. This match was great. Takeshita hit a second rope Raging Fire, which is a Falcon Arrow. Got a great near fall out of it. He hit the Bastard Driver into a wheelbarrow suplex. Ishii, though, jumped up to his feet and killed him with a lariat. Takeshita kicked out a one. They both jumped to their feet. They kind of stumbled, and they both collapsed. Because that's the kind of war they had up until this point. Ishii hit a top rope Frankensteiner. Place was just going nuts for this. Ishii went for the brainbuster. Takeshita, though, countered into a poison Rana. He hit the running power drive knee, but Ishii no-sold it and hit an enziguri, but then he ate a hard forearm shot. Takeshita then hit the raging fire, and he picked up the win. This was fucking great. And the fans treated this like more of a main event than either of the actual main events on these shows. I had this as the second best match of the weekend behind the Omega match. Now, we had some news regarding Takeshita coming out of the show because in the back, he mentioned the fact, he announced that in addition to being affiliated with both AEW and DDT Pro, he is now affiliated with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And Kidani has since said that he believes it is a one-year deal. I'm not even sure how that works if he signed a contract. Yeah, he's already got a contract with AEW, so I'm not sure how his deal is structured, but I mean, I can't see him being allowed to do more than a handful of dates for them each year. But I'll tell you one thing, this man truly is an international champion. Apparently, he has deals with multiple promotions. And now he has multiple belts, too. You know, if New Japan ever gets him full-time, if they had this man, if they had Takeshita full-time, they would have their next Okada. I do believe that. And I don't know that he'll ever go full-time for them, but if they have him even on a part-time deal, that's a huge bonus for New Japan to have Konosuke Takeshita on their shows while they're trying to build up some of these other talents. Again, I mentioned Tsuji and I mentioned Umino. They're trying to build the next generation of stars, even if it's a part-time thing. If they can get Takeshita, which apparently they have, that's a huge feather in their cap. We have the Young Bucks taking on Tetsuya Naito and Hiromu Takahashi, taking on the team of Jeff Cobb and Great O'Conn. This was for the vacant IWGP tag team titles. So yes, in the end, Jeff Cobb was the mystery partner for Great O'Conn. They announced it last night, so they didn't even wait until the show. It's like, yeah, it's going to be Jeff Cobb. But this was the Young Bucks' return to Japan for the first time in 5 years. And their first appearance since losing the AEW tag team titles to Private Party. They look like they haven't missed a beat. They look real good in there. They played their greatest hits. The Bucks hit Naito with the EVP trigger, but Great O'Conn broke up the subsequent pin attempt. Nick Jackson was setting up for the TK driver, but opted for a moonsault outside to the floor first. Then he got back up on the apron, and they did hit the TK driver on Great O'Conn to win the match and to win the IWGP tag team titles. So the Young Bucks are champions once again. Very good match. And you know what that means. Even more belts now on AEW television. Just what we need. The Bucks, Mercedes, Takeshita, all returning to the States with even more belts. After the match, Nick Jackson, he told his brother, "Let's go make love to our wives." I assume they mean separately. I mean, I know they're close and all, but that would be fucking weird. We have Yota Tsuji and Jack Perry. They went one-on-one for the IWGP Global title that Tsuji just won the night before. I thought the match was okay. I wouldn't say any more than that. Tsuji just won the championship, so he wasn't going to lose it here. I mean, he's the future of this company. He's not losing it to Jack Real Glass Crimea River Perry. So this was fine, but nothing more, and Tsuji picks up the win. Then we had the real main event of this show, which was the in-ring return for the first time in more than a year of Kenny Omega, and his first time in a New Japan ring here at the Tokyo Dome in a couple of years. Kenny Omega one-on-one with Gabe Kidd. Omega comes out. He looks to be in tremendous shape. He goes in there. Bell to bell, start to finish, did not miss a beat. Chris Charlton's on commentary. He's going nuts about how, you know, it's basically us against them and treating AEW like the heels. At one point, he called Tony Khan a money mark, talking about how he took away guys like Omega and Okada and Jay White, and he said, "And what have they done there?" And Rocky Romero, he had joined on commentary for this match, and you know, he works for both companies. He's sort of the liaison between the two, and he tries to calm things down. But again, I mean, Chris, whether you agree with what he was saying or not, it's just the number of people that I saw briefly, you know, earlier, treating him as if he went into business for himself, and how, like, inappropriate it is of him to be making comments like this. Like, shut up. The man's doing his job. He's trying to create something out of nothing here. And so is Gabe Kidd, too. Because he, in the weeks leading up to this, you know, online, all the trash talk and everything, he was trying to make this a really hot personal issue. between him and Kenny Omega, even though they only just set this up a couple of months ago, you know, when he attacked Omega backstage at that one New Japan show that he was at, he tried. And what you got here, because, you know, he was out there, and I haven't seen a ton of Gabe Kidd. This is the best he's ever looked. And you could tell that he knew going out there, this was the biggest opportunity of his life. And before I even get into anything else, I will say he made the most of that opportunity here. This was a star-making performance for Gabe Kidd. Kidd was beating up Omega all around ringside. Kenny managed to hit the ring. He flew out of the ring, out to the floor, took out Kidd. And they show him sitting there and he screams, fuck. And he grabs his gut. He grabs his midsection. He is selling his intestines because you see, he had a very bad bout with diverticulitis that almost cost him his life. So he's grabbing on, you know, he's grabbing a hold of his midsection to sell the possibility, oh, it might be flaring up again, you know, or he's not possibly not 100%, even though he's been cleared to wrestle here. So the crowd was booing Omega, not the whole crowd, but it was very noticeable that he was getting some boos. Kenny gave Gabe a powerbomb over the barricade through a table. And me describing it that way doesn't even really do it justice. I mean, this was nasty work. This was a nasty piece of business here. Bryce Remsburg, by the way, officiating his very first New Japan match. He starts screaming for help. He's kneeling, you know, down over Gabe Kidd. He's calling for help. And Omega just ignores him. He starts pounding away at a cut that was opened up on Gabe's head. So now he's bleeding. Kenny gets back in the ring. Everybody else is still outside. So not only is Kidd out of the ring, he's still in that area kind of over the barricade where the announcers are. And there's a bunch of guys, a bunch of dudes are around. Omega's back in the ring, though. He hits a springboard dive over the barricade. And again, the group of dudes, they're there to catch him, but he overshoots all of them and he crashes hard on the ground. So Gabe Kidd fights back. He gets a table, sets it up on the floor. Suplexes Omega through the table. Now Kenny comes up bleeding. Even worse than Gabe Kidd. Kidd threw a bunch of chairs into the ring. Kenny slammed him onto them. Then he went up top. Took too long. Gabe gave him a superplex onto the chairs. Kenny came back with the big Terminator dive out to the floor. Inside he had a top rope dragon suplex. He had a J-driller. Gabe kicked out. Kenny hit the V-trigger, then he went for the one-winged angel, and his intestines gave out. He tried again. Gabe slipped out. He locked on an abdominal stretch to his diverticulitis-ridden intestines. And Kenny was able to escape. Gabe gave him a pile driver. Kenny kicked out. Kidd then gave him a tiger driver variation into a package pile driver. And Kenny was able to get his foot on the bottom rope at the last second. So Omega fought back, hit a V-trigger, hit a powerbomb, hit another V-trigger. Gabe kicked out at one. And finally, Kenny hit the Ibushi Kamigoye and then lifted him up and hit the one-winged angel for the win. I said one-winged angel, and that fucking Excalibur is rubbing off on me. I should have said package pile driver! See, but I didn't do that. This was outstanding. I just gave you the Cliff Notes version. They went 30 minutes. And see, this is a great comparison, actually, because I just got done talking about the main event on night one, okay, Wrestle Kingdom, and how it was overly long, and it didn't have to be. And that you could have a great match that's 20 minutes or 25 minutes. But I said, what I would have done with the Sabre and Umino match is cut it down to where it was about 30-ish. And I think that would have been great. That's what this was. This was about 30 minutes. This was outstanding. And when it was over, they showed Tanahashi sitting at ringside because he joined the Japanese announcers after his match, as he usually does. And they zoom in on his face. He was literally in tears. Now, I would imagine he was in tears because Kenny went out there and had a classic match. And, you know, he knows Kenny is coming back from a potentially career-ending injury and a potentially life-altering or life-threatening injury. And he just came back and had this incredible match. He may have also been emotional because he recognizes what a star-making performance it was for Gabe Kidd, who stepped up in a major way here. Whatever it was, he was overwhelmed with emotion, tears streaming down his face. The complete opposite of the look he had on his face, by the way, when that main event was over the night before. But this was great. And again, Gabe Kidd, tremendous performance. For Kenny Omega, you know, to be off and out of the ring for over a year, after dealing with the illness and the injury and the surgery and everything, and his first night back, to put in that kind of performance, he's already got a match of the year candidate on his resume for 2025. It's his first match back. So I loved everything about this. I thought this was fantastic. Easily the match of the weekend. Nothing else even came close. Then we had the main event. That wasn't even the main event. The main event was Zack Sabre Jr. defending the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship that he retained the night before against Ricochet. No toilet paper on this show for Ricochet. See, the Japanese fans, they don't do that. They'll do streamers, but they won't do toilet paper. Ricochet attacks him before he even gets into the ring. And it's just one big spot after another. You would almost think that they had their time cut to like 2 minutes. The way he was moving. He understood the objective is what happened here. He understood the objective having to follow that Kenny Omega match, which just wasn't going to be possible, but he had to try. He landed a springboard 450 on Zack Sabre Jr. while Zack still had his ring jacket on. Zack eventually was able to cut him off, and he began to apply various holds of death to torture him with. It's got to be just an absolute nightmare to work with this guy. Like, I don't care that it's a work. Like, these holds that he puts you in and the way that he bends this and that and twists you all up into a pretzel. Like, we hear about the joint manipulation with Pete Dunne when we see him on WWE television. And he's very good at that also. But nobody wrestles a match quite like Zack Sabre Jr. And when you watch what he does in there, it just looks like a bad day at the office. Like, I certainly would not want to be working with this guy. But Charlton and Romero on commentary, they started arguing and going back and forth about which was better, the Continental Classic or the G1. Anyway, they fought up top. Zack hit a top rope Zack driver. Then he went for an armbar. Ricochet escaped. He hit his shooting star press, went back up, missed a 630. Which looked like, I mean, that landing looked like it absolutely sucked. Zack hit the PK. He hit a Zack driver, only got two. Ricochet tried for the spirit gun. Zack transitioned, though, into one of his weird submission holds. And Ricochet must have verbally submitted because the referee called for the bell. I enjoyed this more than I did Sabre's match with Umino the night before. There was no chance they were going to top what Gabe Kidd and Kenny Omega did, nor did it have the heated feelings behind it that those two had coming into it. But this was a good main event. It was a fine conclusion, I thought, to a great night of wrestling. Or morning, for me, as it were. Wrestle Dynasty, though, top Wrestle Kingdom. That's for sure. And whatever match of the year contenders came out of this weekend, they all came from the second night. And the big takeaway for me coming out of this show, it's what I said coming into it, what am I most interested in seeing? It had to do with Kenny Omega. Kenny Omega, his first match back, what I was watching for is what kind of Kenny Omega, what version of Omega do we get? Do we get classic Tokyo Dome Kenny Omega? Or maybe he doesn't look quite like the Kenny Omega of old, right? He's been through a very traumatic injury, illness, whatever you want to call it. It might take time for him to ease his way back into things. Maybe he goes out there and has a good match and not a great match. Maybe he's holding back a little bit. Boy, he blew all that shit out of the water. This was classic Tokyo Dome Kenny Omega, who went out there for 30 fucking minutes, and you would never know anything was wrong. Like, physically, he looked in peak condition, and he was hitting all of his big spots. He wasn't holding anything back. And he went out there and had an absolute classic. And so what that means is, if you're Tony Khan, you got to be smiling from ear to ear. Because now you've got prime Kenny back. And he's going to be on Dynamite this week. Probably cutting a promo, I guess. I don't know. They didn't say what he's going to be doing. But Kenny Omega is supposed to be back on Dynamite this week. Good. Not a week too soon. Now that we've established that this guy is back and he can go and he is back to the old Kenny Omega, That is a huge bullet in the chamber for Tony Khan now to use going forward. He already had some people come back. MJF looks like he's finally going to be back now full-time. Kenny Omega now is back. Adam Cole came back from injury not that long ago. He's got, over the last few months, different people back in the mix that he was missing. Kenny was the biggest missing part of the puzzle because he is still automatically one of the biggest stars that Tony Khan has. He needs him. They have tons of talent on that roster, but he needs Kenny Omega. He needs a healthy Kenny Omega. And he passed that test with flying colors this weekend. That much I can tell you. That was my biggest takeaway from this show. Kenny is back. And that is great news if you are Tony Khan or if you are an AEW fan. Someone else who was in Japan this week, they had a Godzilla sighting. That Godzilla was Omos, who is a tag team champion for the second time in his career. The first time was with AJ Styles. This time it is with Jack Morris in Pro Wrestling Noah. They won the GHC tag team titles at the Pro Wrestling Noah show on New Year's Day, the same show where Shinsuke Nakamura got a win over Ulka Sasaki. They beat the legendary Naomichi Marufuji and Takashi Segura. Omos pinned Marufuji after a tree slam. Actually, Marufuji lost to AJ Styles in July. Now he's lost to AJ's former tag team partner. And Omos is now the new Gaijin Monster in Japan. I don't know how many times he's going to be flying back and forth and wrestling over there, but I think an excursion to Japan could do wonders for him. And if Triple H is not using him on the main roster right now, which he clearly is not, then I don't see the harm in letting him spend a few months there and get a few title defenses under their belts before they drop them. It's not like WWE is doing anything with him. Meanwhile, Marufuji said that he got a note recently from Shawn Michaels, and he did not disclose what the note said, but he did say that he was very happy with the contents. So might we see a Marufuji cameo on an NXT show? Can't rule it out. We had Liger on that one show. It was his one and only appearance, but I was there for it. That was a lot of fun to see. At least I could always say that the one and only time I ever got to see Jushin Thunder Liger live, and it was on a fucking NXT show. So if they get Marufuji in for a match or two, I think that'd be great. I'd love to see it. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Imagine you're taking your first vacation of the new year. You want to get away to a warmer climate for the winter. You're headed for parts unknown, and you ignore the flight crew as they're doing their usual safety demonstration. You don't think anything is going to happen. But what if it does? What if the worst happens and that yellow mask, it drops down from the overhead and you start to panic because you weren't paying attention and you have absolutely no idea what to do? That's what it's like going online with that ExpressVPN. Most of the time, you'll probably be fine, but is it really worth the risk? I don't think so. Every time you connect to an unencrypted network in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, your online data is not secure. Any hacker on that same network can gain access to and steal your personal data. All you need is some cheap hardware. A 12-year-old can do it. Hackers make up to $1,000 per person selling your personal info on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. What makes ExpressVPN the best VPN is that it's super secure and it's super easy to use. It would take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. All you have to do is open the app, you click one button, and you're all set. It also works on all of your devices. Whenever I traveled last year, I always made sure to have ExpressVPN active on my phone to keep my important data private, which is the way it should be. That's why it's important to me. My information is not for anyone's eyes but my own. You can never be too careful. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster, and you can get an extra 4 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. You'll notice that I said 4 months free instead of the usual three for the new year. So definitely take advantage of that. It's worth it. Attorneys for Janelle Grant filed a motion this week in court requesting a status conference with all parties in regard to her sex trafficking lawsuit against Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and WWE. as the parties, quote, disagree on a briefing schedule to move this litigation forward, end quote. If you recall, the Justice Department, they asked her lawyers months ago to pause her lawsuit while they continue their own investigation into McMahon. That pause expired last month, and so she is free to move ahead with her lawsuit. And now it sounds like she's planning on amending that lawsuit, and she may file an amended complaint by January 15th, which would effectively reset the clock on everything, basically, because the court would then have to give all the defendants time to respond to the new version of the lawsuit. It's like just starting all over again. Grant's side is stating that they approached the defendants to inform them and seek to work with them on the timeline of the suit, only to be told that they would be going forth with motions to force the lawsuit into arbitration. Now, I think there was some confusion about this because I saw people online saying, oh, of course, she just wanted to settle. Yeah, she just wanted the money. She's not looking for a settlement, at least not yet. She might, but that's not what this is. She is looking to amend the lawsuit. Now, we don't know why. We don't know what she might be adding to the lawsuit. We don't know what she might remove from the lawsuit. But this is about filing an amended version of that lawsuit. It's the Vince McMahon side and the John Laurinaitis side and the WWE side that want the case to go to arbitration. If they can get that move to arbitration, then they avoid having the case go to court. Their argument being that with the NDA that was signed by McMahon and Grant, that was 3 years ago, any dispute arising from that agreement be arbitrated. That's what the language in the NDA said. Her argument is that he breached that agreement by only paying her $1 million out of the $3 million that he promised to pay in exchange for her signing it. And so therefore the agreement is invalid. And that's where we are. So stay tuned. I have absolutely no expectation whatsoever that even if the feds finally charge him with some sort of actual crime and they indicted him, that it would go anywhere for all the obvious reasons. I don't really think I even need to say what they are. He basically got a free pass on that. Now, we know they collected evidence from his home. We know that a grand jury was convened. You know, they asked her to pause her lawsuit for 6 months. I don't know what's taking so long for them to make a decision on this one way or the other, whether they, you know, either charge him or not. I don't know what it is, you know, that's the hang up here. But at this point, none of it even matters. Okay, it's all on her now. It's all on her and the courts to decide if he did breach their contract, and if they don't compel arbitration and it goes to trial, then it's all going to be out in the open, which is not what they want. You know, Vince is not the only defendant here. You got WWE involved. If this goes to trial, I could see a very lucrative offer being made to make all of this go away. And I think it would be very difficult for her to turn that down. It's like Vince finally paying off Rita Chatterton before the sale to Endeavor to make her rape lawsuit go away. Look at the MLW lawsuit. Had that thing gone to trial, it would have been devastating for WWE. Just discovery alone. So they settled for $20 million to make it go away. Court Bauer is the $20 million man now. Janelle Grant is still one person suing a billionaire and suing a billion-dollar company. They can make her life a living hell if they want to. If she gets offered a shit ton of money, it's hard for me to imagine that she doesn't take it and move on with her life. PW Insider broke the story on Friday night that for the first time ever, WWE will be bringing the Royal Rumble to Saudi Arabia in 2026. Now, remember back in May, the chairman of the Saudi Entertainment Authority was on Ariel Helwani's show talking about having discussions with WWE about bringing a WrestleMania or a Royal Rumble to Saudi. So they got their Royal Rumble. They already have the greatest Royal Rumble. I guess this will be even greater, I guess. Now they're getting the real thing. And this marks the first time that the Rumble will be held outside of the United States since it became a pay-per-view way back in 1989. The very first one was a free special on USA Network that was held in Canada as a way to pull viewers away from the Bunkhouse Stampede show that the NWA was doing that same night. Mike Johnson says that he has been told the deal is locked in and that an official announcement could come as soon as this Monday. One thing this confirms in my mind is that Saudi Arabia is definitely getting a WrestleMania, either in 2027 or 2028. You know, they signed a 10-year deal in 2018, so their current deal runs at least through 2028. I don't know if they extended the deal at some point. If they haven't, I have every belief that they will. Because why wouldn't they? Why did they sign the deal in the first place? Right? Because they make too much money on them. It was a huge money deal for them. That hasn't changed. So why would they stop working together? They're getting $50 million for every show they run there. That's $100 million a year. Imagine how much the Saudis are willing to pay for a two-night WrestleMania. I mean, hell, the Royal Rumble could end up being two nights next year. I'm sure some people listening to this right now are very excited. I've got listeners in Saudi Arabia who always attend the other shows that are there. Now they get to go to a Royal Rumble, so I'm sure they're excited. But with the money to be made off something like this, this was always inevitable. You know, now what I'll be interested to see is how many talents, if any, who normally would skip the Saudi shows, also choose to not work the Royal Rumble. Now, I don't know that there are too many of those left. I mean, Kevin Owens used to not go to the shows. Now he does. CM Punk once told Miz to go suck a blood-covered dick in Saudi Arabia. That's what he told him. And he wasn't on the Crown Jewel card in November. Let's see if Punk attends any of the Saudi shows this year. That'll be interesting to follow. It's just hard for me to imagine, assuming that he's healthy, that he just wouldn't go and he would miss their second biggest show of the year. But anything's possible. If they have not extended their deal, though, and they want to bring WrestleMania over there, it would have to be 2027 or 2028. But I would be very surprised if they don't extend that deal. It just made them so much money. If we know anything about TKO, they're in it to make as much money as possible. Case in point, the new ring mats that it looks like we are about to see starting tomorrow night on Netflix. Now, if you watch SmackDown on Friday night, you notice something different about the show. The ring mat is now blue. Now, it is not the cerulean blue of the New Japan rings, but the ring mat is now blue. They're using a blue mat with the usual white ring ropes. I don't mind it. I don't love it. I don't hate it. I'm kind of indifferent to it. I'm all for making little production changes to freshen, you know, the look up of these shows. I would have preferred they go back to the blue ring ropes instead. And blue shirts for the referees, like they had during the Ruthless Aggression era on SmackDown. But if you can't have blue on, you know, you can't have blue ring ropes and you can't have blue referee shirts, then blue mat it is, because you're not going to have blue on blue. They have the blue mats now, and so the white ropes work better than the blue ropes would. You're not going to have blue mats and blue ropes and blue shirts and blue belts and blue balls. It would be too much blue. But when I saw that, my immediate fear was that it meant we would be getting a red ring mat on Monday nights, which would be awful, just like that red Hell in a Cell was. And as I said in my review, I would be okay if they went with a black canvas. Okay, if they want to change it to another color, black works. Black is good, which they've used before for the NXT TakeOver shows. Black mats and red ropes. I think that would be a cool look. And then there was a photo that was leaked online on Friday night, if it is legitimate. Clearly it was taken at SmackDown before the show, if it is legit. It was a photo of a black canvas, but with 9 sponsor logos branded into the mat. Now, one thing about Vince McMahon, he was always against adding stuff like that to the ring mats. He always wanted a clean ring, even when WCW was doing it with their Snickers sponsorship. And they had their Slim Jim sponsorship. They would have their logos branded on the canvas for their pay-per-views. WWE never did that. And I don't even think one or two logos is a big deal. You know, Logan Paul has his Prime logo on the mats for the pay-per-views now. It doesn't ruin my enjoyment of the show. Right? It could be an eyesore, but it doesn't ruin my enjoyment of the show. But right before Vince left for good, Ari Emanuel did an interview, and he said that Vince was now open to increasing the inventory that they could work with, just like Endeavor did with the UFC. Because if you watch a UFC show, that's all you see all over the octagon are sponsor logos. Right? Give it time. You're going to start seeing it on the wrestlers' ring gear, too. I guarantee it. Cody Rhodes is going to be coming to the ring with the Wheatley American Vodka logos on his fucking tights. Brock Lesnar was an innovator and didn't even know it when he came back and had the Jimmy John's logo on his trunks. So that'll be coming next. But in this one photo, we had logos for Netflix, Fortnite, Snickers, Cricket Wireless, Hulk Hogan's Real American Beer, and Riyadh Season. And some of them had doubles. So like there were 2 Riyadh Season logos and 2 Hogan Beer logos, 2 Cricket logos. So there were a total of 9 that I counted on the mat. Now for the record, New Japan had even more than that on its canvas at the Tokyo Dome this weekend. I'm not a fan of it personally, but it doesn't ruin my enjoyment of the show. And if we do get that tomorrow night, if that's a legitimate image and that's what the ring is going to look like on Raw, after a few months, we're all going to get used to it. The funny thing is, though, 10 years from now, when people watch these shows back, they're going to see logos for Hulk Hogan's Real American Beer, and they're going to wonder, what the hell is that? Because it won't even be around anymore. It's going to go the way that all of his other failed business ventures went that he attached his name to, like Pasta Mania and those microwavable Hulkster cheeseburgers, or his first two marriages. There was a report from Dave Meltzer in this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter that with the NXT Level Up show going away, oh, by the way, for those who don't know, NXT Level Up is no longer a thing anymore. For the seven people listening to this, you probably watched it. But there is another new show that will help fill the void, and they are going back to the Evolve name. Now, Evolve was a promotion run by Gabe Sapolsky after he was fired from Ring of Honor in 2008. He was replaced by Adam Pearce. The following year, Gabe started Evolve. And out of Evolve came many names that you see today on WWE and AEW television. Drew McIntyre is a former Evolve champion. Swerve Strickland is a former champion. Austin Theory was one of the last Evolve champions. Gabe formed a partnership with WWE a number of years ago. He even got WWE to air their 10th anniversary special on the WWE Network. It became the first indie wrestling show to ever air on the network. And then in 2020, with the world shut down, so too did Evolve. Or more accurately, they sold the name in the video library to WWE. And WWE had no interest in continuing to run it. You know, they just wanted the IP, and they wanted the library, since so many of their guys came through Evolve at one time or another. It's exactly what they would have done with Ring of Honor if they had acquired Ring of Honor before Tony Khan swooped in and bought it. It would have ended up on a shelf in their warehouse. Well, according to Meltzer, NXT Evolve is coming at some point in 2025, and it will be headed up creatively by none other than Gabe Sapolsky, who has been working for WWE now for a number of years. He says the essence of the show will be similar to NXT Level Up, in that it will feature developmental talents who are not regulars on TV, but that instead of just matches, they're going to be doing promos now, there's going to be angles and storylines, it's going to be booked more like a television show. And where it might air, he didn't say, but it would be taped for TV or for streaming. It will air somewhere. It would not just be live events to get them more experience. Mike Johnson followed up the Meltzer report with one of his own on PW Insider and said that this is what he knows about the Evolve revival, as he puts it. There have been rumors among talents on the independent scene for a month that WWE is bringing back Evolve in some capacity. No one in the company has confirmed this to PW Insider, which is why we haven't reported on it, but since there have been so many emails about it, I wanted to address it here. The belief is that there would be tapings at the Performance Center utilizing the WWE ID talents. Where any of this would air or stream, we have not heard. Some indie talents believe the tapings would be in late January or early February, but we have not heard that is the case. Gabe Sapolsky, who PW Insider is told signed a new deal with WWE late last year, would be in charge of the creative and has been overseeing the WWE ID brand thus far. We have not heard anything firm other than the WWE ID talent were showcased on NXT TV this past Tuesday, quote, for a reason, according to one source. The end of WWE NXT Level Up was not to replace it with Evolve, but with the A&E WWE LFG series, which is currently in production. So there is definitely smoke to this fire. Remember that pilot they shot? That's what this made me remember. There was a pilot. I want to say it was back in 2019. And they shot a pilot episode at the Performance Center for a new show that would have featured a mix of PC talent and Evolve talent. And it would have been overseen by Gabe and Jeremy Borash. And they even had a title belt made with the NXT Evolve branding on it. And there was, I think there was more talk about it after the pandemic, maybe in 2021. Yeah, with the idea that it could be a way to give talent a platform to work because they still weren't running any live events at that point because of the pandemic. But it never went anywhere. Nothing ever happened. this sounds to me like they're just reviving that idea. You know, I would love to see that pilot. Maybe it'll end up on the Vault Channel one day. But that's what this sounds like to me. Only this time it may be a mix of PC talent and WWE ID talent as opposed to Evolve talent, because there is no more Evolve. There is no such thing anymore as an Evolve roster. So that would be the only difference. It probably would be some names from the independent scene that they've signed to WWE ID deals, and then mixed in with people that have even less experience than they do. I think it's a good idea if that's how it works. I don't know if that's how it's going to work, but that's kind of how it sounds to me, because it would give the ID talents a platform to show what they can do and maybe get signed quicker to an NXT deal or a main roster deal. But it would also put PC talents in the ring with more experienced wrestlers. Now, they already do that on NXT. They have lots of main roster talents. They cycle in and out of that show. But not all of the folks at the PC are on NXT yet. You know, with Level Up, if you have a bunch of PC talents working against each other and they don't know what they're doing, how are they supposed to get better, right? Let them work with people that actually have a little more experience. That would make more sense to me. We had our first three-hour edition of SmackDown this past Friday night. Only two really worthwhile segments on the show, one of which was a Paul Heyman promo that was interrupted by Solo Sikoa, and the other one being the women's championship match between Nia Jax and Naomi. I'll get to that in a second, but the segment with Heyman came out, gave us the backstory, basically, to the Roman Reigns-Solo Sikoa storyline heading into Tribal Combat on the Netflix debut tomorrow night. That brought out Solo Sikoa. They went back and forth, and it ended up that Solo Sikoa introduced Paul Heyman into the match, in that the winner of Tribal Combat will have the Ulafala placed upon their neck after the match is over by Heyman. So Heyman is going to either have to put the Ulafala around Roman Reigns' neck or possibly put it around the neck of Solo Sikoa. I thought it was as good of a go-home segment as they could do, because Roman Reigns was not there on Friday. So there wasn't, beyond a video they could have done, there wasn't a whole lot else to be done. They've now made Heyman part of this match on Monday. Now, there's somebody else who may be part of this match on Monday in some form or fashion, and that is The Rock. Now, they aired a commercial on Friday night for the Netflix debut, the first time that we've seen The Rock included in the commercial. So I was already convinced he was going to be on the show regardless. And then there were reports, you know, he's presenting tonight at the Golden Globe Awards, which is being held in Los Angeles, which is, I think, going to be 20 minutes away from where WWE is going to be tomorrow night. But we don't have to speculate anymore, because The Rock came out on social media this morning and confirmed that he will be there for the Netflix premiere in LA tomorrow night. What is he going to be doing? You know, is he going to come out and say hello? Is he going to come out and say nothing like he did at Bad Blood? I have to imagine there's a specific role in mind for him on this show. And I just think, you know, with what you have going on here, if you have a battle between two Bloodline members for the Ulafala and the right to call themselves the Tribal Chief, and The Rock is in the building, why would he not be involved in that in some way, right? It's family business. But there have been so many rumors about potential WrestleMania matches. Rock and Roman is always going to be at the top of that list until they actually do it. But then there's Cody and Rock, and now there's talk about Roman Reigns against CM Punk being discussed internally, playing off the favor that Heyman still owes Punk. If it's Roman and Punk, how does Rock fit into that? Right? I don't know that he does. So it makes me wonder if we really are going to get Rock and Roman in Las Vegas after all. You know, is Rock even wrestling on that show, or is he going to be involved in some other way? There's a lot of questions that are going to be answered tomorrow night. I think the show is going to give us a good sense of at least some of the direction for WrestleMania. You know, usually you don't get that until the Royal Rumble. That's still a month away. But I think we're going to get a pretty good sense of at least a couple of things tomorrow night. Nia Jax and Naomi, they had another really good match that ended the same way their last match did in November, with Naomi falling short of winning the championship. Tiffany Stratton ran out late in the match to tease yet another potential Money in the Bank cash-in, only to assault the referee before he could have Lillian Garcia make the announcement. Then she waffles Naomi in the head with the briefcase and allows Nia Jax to hit the Annihilator and retain the title. And the announcers are selling this like this was a ruse the entire time. Like this was all part of some master plan. Only for Tiffany to then whack Nia in the back with the briefcase. She gets rid of Candice LeRae. Bianca Belair gets Nia up on her shoulders for a KOD, which looked super impressive. And Tiffany throws Bianca clear over the announce desk, so that gets rid of her. And then she finally cashes in her money in the bank. We got a bell, she hit the prettiest moonsault ever, and she pins Nia Jax to win the Women's World Championship. One of the best Money in the Bank cash-ins in a very long time. I know Damian Priest had a cash-in at WrestleMania this year, you know, and I get that it's WrestleMania, so it's a big deal. But what I loved about this one was how they made you think it was going to be a letdown. Only for Tiffany to outsmart everybody and then win the title. And thank God it's over. I understand doing a few teases here and there so that when you finally get to the moment, you've led people to think it's going to just be more of the same. But then you drop the bomb on them. Like, I get that. But it just got to the point of absurdity where I was just ready for it to be over with. It was almost every single week. So I always figured she was going to win the title whenever it would actually happen. But it was just like, okay, what are they going for here? But they did a great job with it, I thought, on Friday. Tiffany is now the champion. Nia Jax, you know, her reign is over, at least for now. She had the best year of her career in 2024. She came back to the company. She started the year. She had a really good match on TV against Becky Lynch. Right? She headlined the Elimination Chamber against Rhea Ripley in Australia. Won Queen of the Ring. Won the Women's World Championship at SummerSlam and held on to it until Friday night. And there were a number of very good matches that she had, right? She didn't have great matches with everybody. And I said this the other night, I thought she looked terrible in the War Games match, but she had the best run that she has had in her entire career. Hopefully that could extend into 2025. I don't necessarily need to see her win the world title on the other brand. You know, we'll give some other people a chance, but yeah, I just thought it was worth mentioning because there are a lot of people who still shit on Nia for the sake of shitting on Nia. And there are also a lot of people who give her flowers now in a way that she didn't get before. Because there were no flowers to be given. But I don't see how you can look at the run that she had last year and say that, oh, she's, you know, as bad as she used to be, or she's the shits, or this or that. She served her purpose. You know, she played her role. She was the monster heel champion on that brand. And she went out there and she had a number of really good matches. So good for her. But now, Charlotte Flair is going to be back imminently. And she's going to have her own cash in. And I still think that it's going to be Charlotte challenging Tiffany for the title of WrestleMania. I think that's what's on the agenda. And if they do it, whether they want to or not, I think the fans are going to dictate that Tiffany be the babyface and Charlotte be the heel. And yeah, I could see Charlotte winning the title from her. And then Tiffany has to fight to get it back, which would then solidify her babyface run. Whatever the outcome would be, I do think that's going to be the direction for WrestleMania. It's just hard for me to imagine Charlotte coming back soon and not being involved in one of the two women's championship matches at WrestleMania. So tomorrow night is the big debut. The Raw on Netflix era begins, and the final preview for the show looks like this. We know The Rock is going to be there. We know John Cena is going to be there. It's going to be the first stop on his farewell tour. I will be watching to see if he becomes the first to declare for the Royal Rumble. Wouldn't that be something if The Rock declared for the Royal Rumble? The Rock doesn't have to declare for the Royal Rumble. He's The Rock. He's on the board. He wants a championship match. He could just appoint himself. But I think there's a pretty good chance John Cena will do that. Logan Paul is going to be there as well. He is now officially a member of the Raw roster. CM Punk and Seth Rollins go one-on-one. That's the real main event. Roman Reigns is going to wrestle Solo Sikoa. Tribal combat for the Ulafala. Liv Morgan defends the women's world title against Rhea Ripley. I was of the impression it was going to be a last woman standing match, and now it looks like that is not the plan. And it looks like it's going to be a regular match. So I don't know if the last woman standing stuff was just a troll that was going around social media, or they changed their mind, or what happened. But it looks like it's going to be a regular match. And Jey Uso goes one-on-one with Drew McIntyre. And who knows what other surprises they may have on the show. So that is the schedule. Of course, I will be live immediately after Raw tomorrow night, whenever it ends, because we still don't have clarity on exactly how long that, at least the first episode, is going to be. I imagine it'll be at least 3 hours, maybe more. And whenever it's over, I'll be live on YouTube, so you better be there for the full recap. But to that end, as far as the length of the show, we got a little more clarity, but not really, from Triple H, who was on the SI Media podcast with Jimmy Traina and talked about the runtime on Netflix and how flexible it'll be. He said it'll be flexible in that I don't think necessarily the time constraints of network television or cable television apply. It's a slightly different form. It's a slightly different platform. I think much like many shows, whether dramas or whatever, but episodic shows, they have the ability to do whatever the show needs to have done. So if this episode needs to be an hour, great, it's an hour. This next episode needs to be 42 minutes, it's 42 minutes. It's what makes for the best product. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to be 42 minutes. Oh, God, that'd be fantastic. 42 minutes. Let's go from 3 hours to 42 minutes. I'd have to pack a lot into those 42 minutes. That's probably too short. But now you're speaking more my language. He goes, but clearly we will deliver the product in a way that is best for Netflix and for the business model and for what is best for our storytelling. Sometimes you get into the two-hour show and you just don't have the real estate on that program to get everything in there that you want to get in. And all the stories that you want to get in and all the characters that you want to get in. And there are people that are getting left off. Sometimes 3 hours can feel long. Sometimes 2 hours is not enough. Somewhere in the middle, to me, is the sweet spot. So, again, clarity in that he's admitting that they will be able to be flexible each week with the times, but not exactly clear on what that means and how long the show is going to be. I don't disagree with him that sometime between 2 and 3 hours is the sweet spot. That sounds about right. You know, and if we have weeks where Raw sometimes is 2 hours and 20 minutes, and then another week it's 3 hours, then okay, so be it. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the full 3 hours every week. I like the idea of them being flexible with it. Now, speaking of Netflix, the Raw Vault has been added to Netflix, and this is domestically and internationally. PW Insider Mike Johnson was talking about this. Said that he was getting emailed from people that not all of the episodes are there. He says that was always the plan. Says they're going to be adding new content every month to that area. Internationally, the SmackDown and NXT vaults will be similar with new content added on a regular basis. They're not going to be putting everything up at once because the idea is to keep people paying for new content. So if you give them everything all at once, once they get it and they watch what they want to watch, they have no reason to pay. Well, not that you don't have any reason to pay for Netflix. I mean, there's a lot of other content on Netflix. But if you're only subscribed for WWE, then you don't necessarily need to continue paying for Netflix if you get everything that you want all at once. So basically, they'll be adding content on a rolling basis, is what he's saying. And if you're in the US, right now it's only the Raw Vault that you can find on Netflix. All the other content, SmackDowns and, you know, PLEs and home videos and all that stuff, that's still on Peacock. The deal with Peacock is still in effect through March of 2026. So it's going to be a while. But if you use Netflix already, you already know the interface. I was playing around with it the other day just to see what content was up there. I mean, I like it. I like the interface. Some of these streaming services, I'm not a fan of the interface. I'm not a huge fan of Peacock. For that reason, Netflix, I like. I think it's organized in a way that's easy to know where everything is. I like how they break everything down by year with some of the episodes next to each year. Right now, they only have 7 episodes from 1993, for example. But they've got all 52 episodes listed for each of the last 3 years, which, of course, are the episodes I care the least about. If I'm going into the vault, I can promise you I'm not looking for shit from 2023. Or 2024. So we're just going to have to wait for episodes to be added on whatever schedule it is that they're going to work by. You know, I was kind of hoping they would add the Raw Vault to the Vault channel on YouTube and just, you know, if not everything up at once, just start adding episodes there. But apparently it'll go up on Netflix at their pace. So if you want to pop on there and watch a Raw episode from 1995, well, you're probably going to be shit out of luck, unless it's the 7 episodes or whatever they have up right now for 1995. But anyway, that's the way that that's going to work. Dynamite Fight for the Fallen took place on Wednesday night. That was the New Year's Day episode of Dynamite, the first of the new year, the first simulcast live on Max. Oh, speaking of Max, since I was just talking about Netflix, all of the early AEW shows from 2019 are now up on Max. So I went and I checked that out as well. I checked out the Netflix stuff. I said, let me go check out what their interface looks like as far as the AEW content on Max. It's fine. The one thing, I have a bone to pick with Max right now, completely unrelated to this, because they just pulled all of the West Wing seasons off of Max on New Year's Day without any warning. And I just so happened to be in the middle of watching the series for the very first time. So imagine my surprise when I went to go eat dinner the other night, and I went and I go, wait a minute, how come it's not there anymore? I'm like, thanks, Max. So yeah, they can fuck off for that. But otherwise, I mean, user interface wise, it looks fine. The first 12 episodes of Dynamite from October through December of 2019 are now available, as well as 17 consecutive episodes of Dynamite, Collision, and Rampage from October 30th through December 21st, 2024. Their first five specials and pay-per-views from 2019 are also up there on Max, starting with Double or Nothing, all the way through Full Gear. And again, we don't know what the schedule is going to be for future uploads, other than it will be on a rolling basis. So go check that out right now. A lot of good stuff there from 2019. I was actually sitting here the other day watching part of, what was it, Fyter Fest? Whatever episode it was that had the first Cody and Darby Allin match. And then we had the sick chair shot to the head by Sean Spears at the end of it. I had forgotten how nasty that was, where Cody was laying on the mat, and then you just see literally a pool of blood is forming around his skull. And I had forgotten how just disgusting that looked. But also, they have the first season of AEW All Access, which was their reality show. That's up there as well. But Dynamite on Wednesday, we had in the main event, we had Adam Copeland and FTR in a trios match taking on the Death Riders. So it was the team of Jon Moxley, Claudio Castagnoli, and Wheeler Yuta. Pac apparently is once again back home. I don't know if it was just for the holidays. I don't know if he's going to be there for a while. He's one third of the trios champions. You know, he takes these breaks where he just disappears for weeks, if not months at a time. Hopefully he's back this week, because if he's not, then I don't know what the hell he's doing as one third of the trios champions. But apparently he just doesn't want to move to the States. I mean, look, I don't blame him, but he wants to be home. I get it. But because of that, he sometimes will vanish. So he's been missing the last couple of weeks. But Copeland is no longer Adam Copeland. He is now going by just Cope. Short, simple, and sweet, according to Excalibur. And I know he's going by Cope, not only because that's how he was announced and because of what they had on the screen, on the lower third, but because the announcers wouldn't shut up about it and said that name about 5,000 times on commentary during the main event. And it's jarring, because here's somebody, he's not a rookie. He's not a new guy. He's been around for decades. 50 years old. He's been in the business now across multiple decades. Now he's going through yet another name change. Now, he explained why in an interview with Renee Paquette last year. There's video of that going around. This was an interview that he did with her. It was right before Double or Nothing in May when he broke his leg. He was talking then about how little by little he wants to segue into Cope. Because in his mind, the rated R superstar Adam Copeland is very wordy. And he was thinking of it in terms of like a marquee. If you look at the match on the marquee and it says Mox, it says Cope against Mox, which, funny enough, is the example he was giving even back then. That's a lot easier to digest and a lot easier to see than, I guess, Copeland. I mean, what are we really talking about here? We're talking about four letters. You're adding the word land after Cope. It's not like his last name is Schwarzenegger. I mean, it's not that big of a deal. It's not that wordy. So yes, it sounds dumb. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of Michael Cole calling Nakamura Shin on TV. You want to call him Shin in the back? You want to call him Shin if you're a buddy of his? Fine, I get it. But what is this Shin shit on my TV? Stupid. But I will say this about the name change. As somebody who takes notes during these shows and has to do so very quickly because I'm going live right after the shows, it is easier for me to type out Cope or Edge than it would be Copeland. So there is that. But they have announced another casino gauntlet match for Dynamite this coming Wednesday, the winner of which will receive a shot at Jon Moxley's AEW World Championship on the January 15th episode of Dynamite, which they are calling Maximum Carnage. It's a little weird that they're doing this, given that Copeland is clearly being positioned to challenge Moxley very soon. But they're going to do that match. Now, the other casino gauntlet matches they've done, they've had three or four of them at this point, have all been fun. So I'm sure it'll be a fun match. We don't know the names of everybody that are going to be in the match, not yet. Although we do know the name of one. We know the name of two. We know that Jay White is going to be in there because he won a triple threat match on Wednesday. He's going to be entering the gauntlet at number one, which is good for him because in these gauntlets, it's one fall to a finish. So you can conceivably end the gauntlet in the first 5 minutes of the match. You can be the first two people in. If you get a pinfall or a submission, you win. That's it. The match is over. So you want to be number one. So Jay White is going to be number one. But do you know who else threw their name into the hat for the gauntlet on Wednesday? The Last Outlaw, Jeff Jarrett, who came out to make an announcement about his career on Wednesday, teasing the idea that maybe he was going to be retiring. He even took his boots to the ring with him. That was the swerve, I guess. Now that I look back on it now, it's like, yeah, well, why else would he have his fucking boots in the ring? It was just to swerve us. So, of course, he did not announce his retirement. Quite the opposite, in fact. He said that he recently re-signed with AEW. He signed what will be his last talent contract. He didn't say for how long. He didn't say how many years. But he signed a new deal, and he has made it a priority. He has made it his New Year's resolution to win gold in AEW, but not just any gold. He wants to have a shot at, and he wants to take possession of, the AEW World Championship. And he's even entered himself into the Casino Gauntlet match this Wednesday because he wants the AEW World title. As I said in my review, if he wants the AEW World title, he can buy it off shopaew.com like everybody else. Because the idea of Jeff Jarrett going for or winning the AEW World Championship, and yes, do I think he's going to win the world title? No, I don't think he is. But there's a lot of people out there going, whoa, come on, Solid Monster, he's not going to win. You know he's not going to win. You can't say that with any degree of absolute certainty. We know how Tony Khan likes to treat the legends. And yes, Jeff Jarrett is a legend in the business. But you know how Tony Khan thinks about these things. If Tony Khan wants to do a solid for Jeff Jarrett and wants to pay respect to Jeff Jarrett, you don't think Tony Khan wouldn't be willing to give Jeff Jarrett a world title win, even if only on a fluke? You're going to completely disqualify that idea? Because I'm not ready to do that. It could very well happen. They're going to build a story around this now. And, you know, it's one thing to build a story that you think people will emotionally be able to invest in. I personally don't think that Jeff Jarrett is at that level where you could have done a story like this, let's say, with Sting. They kind of already did a story like this with Bryan Danielson, right? There are certain people where it would work. I don't look at Jeff Jarrett as somebody who the fans, by and large, are going to invest in the same way that they did those guys. I don't see it. And I see a lot of other people on this roster that should be in the hunt, challenging for and chasing after the AEW World Championship. But that's about the only good thing I could even say about this, is that it's another name on a long list, a growing list of names who have made it their mission to become the AEW World Champion. Cope, Jay White, Eggman Page. MJF finally said he wants his belt back on Wednesday night. Hallelujah. I thought he forgot all about it. He said he wants his Triple B back. Now Jeff Jarrett is in the mix. The one good thing about that, it makes your top title feel that much more important when everybody wants a piece of it. So that's good. But this Jeff Jarrett stuff, I mean, who gives a shit? I mean, what are we even doing here? By the way, I caught last night's Collision for a change. It was the first one to stream live on Max, because I watched Dynamite on TBS this week, so I figured, all right, you know what? I want to see how the viewing experience is for one of these live shows on Max, so I'll watch it on there. And it was fine. I didn't have any issues. Picture in picture, or not picture in picture, but picture was clear. I had no problems. In a week where Tony Khan, by the way, debuted the Pointer Sisters for the new Dynamite intro theme. And he also brought back Elton John for the Collision intro. It's too bad they canceled Rampage, and Tony couldn't use Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry for the intro. By the way, this was on a show last night that featured Jeff Jarrett and the Rock and Roll Express. And Edge pinning Chris Jericho in the main event. We had Daniel Garcia and Private Party. Okay? They are two sets of AEW originals who are walking around with championships now, and that's nice to see. Except, Private Party has been stone cold ever since they beat the Bucks for the belts. So it was nice to see them pick up a win over Action Andretti and Leo Rush, but those tag team titles have never, in the history of this company, those tag team titles have never felt less important than they do right now. And I don't put the blame on Private Party for that. It's not their fault. They waited so long, and the Outrunners got hot. The Outrunners are still more over than all the other teams. But Private Party doesn't even get booked on Dynamite anymore, so of course the titles don't feel important. Why would they? Then you got Garcia. Right after he won the TNT title, the Continental Classic started, and he lost a bunch of matches, which isn't a great way to build momentum after your big title win. Now, he beat Mark Briscoe last night. They had a good outing. I know Kyle Fletcher is going to want one more match with Will Ospreay, but Fletcher does have a win over Garcia in the Continental Classic, so he should be in line for a shot at the title, and if he gets one, I would not be beating Kyle Fletcher again. I'll just say that. They had what they billed as a $100,000 high-speed collision four-way, with Brian Cage beating Dante Martin, Commander, and the Beast Mortos. How they came to select those four to go for the $100,000, I have no idea. Stipulations like this are pretty toothless, unless there's a story tied into it that actually goes somewhere, which clearly here there is not. I mean, it worked well with Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid back in the day when Razor kept offering him money to get him back in the ring after he lost to him the first time, right? He was embarrassed. So he offered him like $2,500. The kid said no. $5,000. The kid said no. The kid was cutting promos, or they were having videos there, promos, him talking about his grandmother or something. And he would always just say no, 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 no. And then finally, Razor offered him, I'll give you $10,000. If you step back into the ring with me. So finally he said yes. And then the kid made off with the money. What did that lead to? That led to Ted DiBiase mocking Razor over it. Right? Not only did you get embarrassed by this kid, but he stole your money. That led to the Razor Ramon babyface turn. The kid getting $10,000, it would have meant nothing to me, but they took the time to establish why it meant something to him. And it actually led to something significant. Brian Cage wins $100,000. Who cares? So now that, combined with whatever Tony is paying him in kayfabe, he'll be the highest paid mid-carder on the roster. Congratulations. We had a Jeff Jarrett squash win over Aaron Solo. He got what I would call a respectful reaction. He didn't even get the level of reaction he got from the crowd on Wednesday. Can you blame them? They're sitting there watching Jeff Jarrett getting enhancement wins in 2025 like it's Wrestling Challenge in 1995. I don't blame these people. They aired footage from backstage at Dynamite on Wednesday. Alex Marvez was hoping to get a word with Hangman Adam Page. He found him, though, in a very heated discussion with Christopher Daniels. They're doing something here with Hangman and Christopher Daniels. This has been going on now for weeks. And Daniels is telling Hangman, look, you could be a world champion, and I believe in you. And Page said, your belief doesn't mean shit to me. I needed you at World's End. You said you were a friend. You'd be there for me. I needed you. You weren't there. Daniels, look, what was I supposed to do? He says. So Page asked what Daniels has given the company in pro wrestling. And he says when he looks at Daniels, he sees an old man clinging onto a sport that left him behind a long time ago. And he said that if Daniels hadn't lost his mind to old age, he would have hung it up 5 years ago when he still had an ounce of dignity. So then Daniels slaps him. And Hangman says, that's what I thought. And he starts to walk away. And then Daniels, you can hear him yell, Hangman, to get his attention. And he attacks him. He attacks Hangman Page from behind. He's kicking his ass. He starts headbutting him to the point where now he's bleeding. And that's how this ended. He left Hangman laying. I'm watching this and I'm just thinking, I don't believe what I'm seeing here. Like, I wanted to see, because he didn't win at World's End. I didn't think he would in the four-way. I said, hopefully they have something really good lined up for Hangman heading into the new year. This is not what I had in mind. What is this? Now he's feuding with Christopher Daniels, an aging retired wrestler who is a behind-the-scenes authority figure? Like, this is the best we can come up with here for this guy? I mean, there are times where you can do an angle like that could work. Like, if we're tuned into SmackDown next week, let's say, and Kevin Owens beat up Nick Aldis, and it was a way to get Nick Aldis out of retirement to have him. Like, you could make that work. Like, you know what I mean? Like, even with Adam Pearce, I feel like that's something you can make it work. Here with Christopher Daniels, though, like, Hangman Page just got his ass kicked by Christopher Daniels. And by the way, I love the fact that in the back, they're in the back. It's a backstage segment with Christopher Daniels. We still have to have blood. We need blood. We must have blood in this backstage segment. What are we doing here? Another aging star beating up one of their young stars. What are we doing? So now I guess we wait for Hangman to murder this man. But it just feels to me like this is as good of an idea as we have for the time being. We don't really have anything better for Hangman, so we'll just have him work a program with Christopher Daniels. Great. They showed FTR backstage with the Rock and Roll Express, who brought up the angle from 2021 where FTR hit Ricky Morton with a spike pile driver. I think this was back during the Pinnacle days. And Dax apologized for that. And then the Outrunners walked in and they were complaining about gas money that they were owed by the Rock and Roll Express from 1982. And Ricky Morton said the Outrunners weren't even born in 1982. But he apologized and the Outrunners did their signature handshake. And Ricky did all the talking, by the way. Robert Gibson said nothing. He just stood there and smiled. But that led into the main event trios match with Cope and FTR beating Chris Jericho, Big Bill, and Brian Keith. And then they cut to Jon Moxley in the back, and the Death Riders had tied up the Rock and Roll Express and taped their mouths shut. So that was pretty goofy. Although I guess it's no worse than them kidnapping people or pouring drain cleaner down their throats. Clearly they're setting up for a world title match between Moxley and Copeland, and Copeland should not win that. But it feels a lot more likely that Rated FTR are going to be the ones to take the Trios titles from the Death Riders, if Pac ever comes back. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You could email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Daniel from Los Angeles. At Bad Blood, we got the tease from The Rock with his 3-2-1 and the throat cut gesture. What if that was for the Royal Rumble? He enters in later on with the help of the new bloodline, ends up in the final four. These four being Punk, Rock, Rollins, and Cena. Punk and Rollins take each other out, leaving Rock and Cena. The Rock wins and punches his ticket to WrestleMania. The next night, The Rock chooses Cody, and we get that as WrestleMania main event night two. What do you think? Also, if The Rock descends from his mountain with his with this decree, what would you have the other main event be? What do I think of that idea? I don't really like it. So I hope it doesn't happen. I'll just say that. As far as what would the other main event be if that's what it was? So we get Rock and Cody. It's not even that I necessarily mind them doing Rock and Cody, but the idea that to get there you need The Rock to win the Royal Rumble, I don't think you do. But let's say we get Rock and Cody on one night, then you do Roman and Punk. I mean, that's it. That's the other main event. You're not going to do Rock and Roman, then you're going to do Roman and Punk. Roderick from Baltimore. I know many of us are anticipating a Tiffany Stratton versus Charlotte Flair title match at WrestleMania this year. But what are the chances we see Triple H go a different direction and complete the Rhea Ripley-Charlotte Flair WrestleMania trilogy first for the Women's World title while holding off Charlotte and Tiffany for 2026? They could build Rhea and Charlotte up as the female version of the Austin Rock WrestleMania trilogy and possibly put together some sort of WWE Network documentary or special chronicling the history between the two of their all-time greatest female stars. Plus, Rhea and Charlotte could potentially main event night one, the spot they missed out on in Hollywood, which was the correct call. Meanwhile, Tiffany defends her women's title this year on night two against Bianca Belair. After Bianca wins the women's chamber, this is another program in Mania match that is bound to happen at some point. I don't disagree that at some point it's bound to happen, but it ain't going to be this year. The play is Tiffany and Charlotte. I don't think we need to see Rhea and Charlotte again. I mean, you first of all, don't ever use Rhea and Charlotte and Rock and Austin in the same vein. It's just not a great analogy to be using, comparing Austin Rock to anybody else. I don't think that it's so great that it needs the documentary treatment and all this other stuff. Their last match was excellent. And yes, it technically would be the WrestleMania trilogy. Their first match was in the empty warehouse at 36. But I don't think you need to have another Rhea and Charlotte match yet. I hope that's not what they do. Again, not saying they wouldn't go out there and have a kick-ass match. They certainly could. Far more Rhea Ripley matches with other opponents that we still haven't gotten that I would much rather see than Rhea and Charlotte again. Tiffany and Charlotte is a match that we have not seen. Rhea Ripley and Bianca Belair would be a match that we have not seen, certainly not on a big stage like WrestleMania. Rhea and Io is also another choice. I would love to see that match. Why do we need to go back to the same match that we've already seen twice before? Carlos from New York, thoughts on this AEW title arc going forward. Moxley defends against Jeff Jarrett at the AEW show on January 15th. Yeah, so what he's referring to is the winner of that Casino Gauntlet this week is going to get their world title match on the 15th, the following week. So that's what he's referring to there. So Jarrett, I guess in this scenario, then Jarrett wins the gauntlet. Is that what you're suggesting to me, Carlos? So then he gets a world title match on the 15th. Moxley builds to Adam Copeland in Australia. Darby gets a title shot, winning at Revolution, losing the following Wednesday on AEW to Christian. Boy, this sounds an awful lot like what I laid out a few weeks ago. Christian builds to Jay White. Jay White beats him not long after, building then to Jay White against Adam Page at All In, where Page breaks his losing streak to White, who then builds to Swerve towards the end of 2025. I don't see there being that many title changes this year. I mean, the title has been pretty stable, and I'm all for shaking things up a little bit, and not everybody needs to have a super long title run, but what you just laid out there is like four or five different title changes this year. I don't see it. I think Christian, if he wins the title, it is going to be relatively brief. I don't see him having the championship for too long. But like Christian and Jay White at All In, I mean, I like Jay White, but I think we could do better than that. I think we could do better. Although he's saying Christian builds to Jay White and Jay White beats him, which leads to White against Hangman. Okay, so Hangman and Jay White at All In. It's a little bit better, but I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of eventually circling back to Hangman and Swerve, but not for a while. You know, at least the end of this year, I agree. You want to put some more distance, you know, between the two of them before you go back to it. It just feels inevitable that eventually when they do circle back to it, it'll be for the world championship. So, I mean, I like that aspect of the idea, but I don't know. I just feel like the world title match at All In, you know, we could have a bigger match. Not sure yet what that would be. I don't think that's it, though. George from Manchester. 2025 is the final time we see John Cena as an in-ring performer. Do you think we finally see a heel, top of the card, John Cena? Does Triple H do what his father-in-law would never do? I'm not going to sit here and say never, because I never thought we would see this final boss version of The Rock that we have, which turned out to be great. So I will tell you, though, I feel like the likelihood of heel Cena in his final year is very, very slim. Now, they have an entire year. Shawn Michaels did a heel turn in 2005 that didn't last nearly as long as it should have, but he turned heel. And how long did he turn heel for? A month? I don't even know if it was a full month. Maybe it was about a month. I think it was because if I remember, I think he kicked Hogan in the face on July 4th. I want to say SummerSlam that year was maybe like August 3rd. So yeah, I think Michaels was heel for about a month. You got Cena for a year. You want to do a heel turn with Cena for like 3 or 4 months? I mean, I guess you could. I just don't think they're going to do it. I just feel like because it is his final year, every city they go to, it's going to be John Cena's final time. They're already doing it with like Elimination Chamber in Toronto. John Cena's final time in Toronto. Right? They're going to do that everywhere they go. And people are not going to want to boo him. They're just not. There was a point in time where all they wanted to do was boo him. At this point, I feel like it's too late. It's not that I don't think he has it in him. I just feel like it's his retirement tour. People are not going to want to boo John Cena on his retirement tour. And if they're not going to want to boo John Cena, then why are you going to turn him heel and handicap your baby faces like that if they're just going to cheer for him? So do I think Triple H does what Vince would never do? No, I don't. But I do think if Triple H had the book 10 years ago, he would have. He would have had the guts to do what Vince McMahon did not. Now I feel like it's too late. Isaac from Brantford, Ontario, Canada. With the recent introductions of a women's U.S. and Intercontinental title, plus the influx of women in NXT, do you think WWE will run another Evolution show in the near future? Doesn't necessarily have to be a PLE, but maybe an NBC special, since they will be obligated to produce 4 of them annually. If you think that they're going to take one of the NBC specials and just make it an all-women show, I got a bridge I can sell you. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Evolution is a PLE, also, I think, very unlikely. I think if they wanted to do it, it would have been done by now. They certainly have the talent to give it a shot if they wanted to, but I don't see it happening this year. I just don't. Jack in Minnesota, racking my brain about who makes sense for the briefcases this year, and two names that make sense are Karrion Kross and maybe Jade Cargill for the women. Too early to call it, but what's your take? My take is that it's too early to call it. Had somebody asked me the other day, who do I think wins King of the Ring? I said, Drew McIntyre. Money in the Bank? I have no idea. Karrion Kross, I like some of the work he's been doing recently. I don't see Karrion Kross winning Money in the Bank. I don't see Jade winning Money in the Bank. So I don't think it's going to be either of them, but it's just too early. It's too early. I mean, if I had a good prediction for you, I would have included it in my prediction show. Jose from New York City. Since FTR has teamed with Cope, what do you think is FTR's best trios team? Is it FTRKO with Randy Orton? I have no memory of that. CMFTR with CM Punk? Or Rated FTR with Cope? CMFTR with Punk. Alberto in Laredo, Texas. I was recently watching the 2004 Red Sox Netflix documentary on their comeback. In your opinion, what is wrestling's greatest comeback? Kenta Kobashi. How could it be anything else? Kenta Kobashi beating cancer and returning to the ring. To me, that's the correct answer. You don't even need to be a huge fan of Japanese wrestling. If you know who Kenta Kobashi is and you know of his battle with cancer and his return to the ring and that pop that he got, that first entrance back, that whole moment, the answer is Kobashi. Shawn Michaels, I would put after that, not only because he came back and managed to put together an entire second half of his career that rivaled, or some might say even exceeded, the first half, and he was gone for 4 years, but he was one step away from becoming another sad story. But he turned his life around and he came back a different person than he was beforehand. So I feel like I would have to put him in number 2. And I think you got to have CM Punk on that list, because it may not have ended with AEW the way that he wanted it to, but that return in 2021 after 7 years away in Chicago at the United Center, that was something special. And that still to this day is one of the loudest, and I wish I could have been in the building for it, one of the loudest pops and sustained reactions in wrestling that I have ever heard. That was a special moment. Kyrul from Malaysia, been a fan since 2015. With the recent move to Netflix, can you recommend me best matches or moments from WWE? Between 1990 and 1999, I've been a fan of WWE since I was a child, but did not have the resources to watch until now. I caught up from 2000 onwards, but never managed to watch anything prior to that. So you're in Malaysia, so I wonder what content you have access to from WWE on Netflix, because I know it's different than here in the States. It's just Raw for us. So assuming you have access to all the pay-per-views and stuff, I mean, that's a pretty open-ended question. You're asking me to recommend matches and moments, you know, from the entire 90s decade. I mean, I can give you a laundry list. I would start you out with, I would start you out with matches like Hell in a Cell in 97 between Shawn and The Undertaker. Bret Hart and Steve Austin wrestled that same year. Bret Hart and Steve Austin, WrestleMania 13. Shawn Michaels and Razor, the ladder match, WrestleMania 10. Their ladder rematch at SummerSlam in 95. Bret and Owen, Savage and Flair at WrestleMania. I mean, dude, we could be here all day. Start with those, and then we'll see what else we can come up with. We've got Molly from Toronto. You usually have those buy, rent, and sell questions, but I wanted to try something different related to best opening matches. It would be like if those matches were all booked on the same card. Which would you put on the pre-show, keep as the opening match, put as a main event, or what match would you remove from the card completely? Okay, so that's the criteria. By the way, you said best opening match. Of course, if this was Meltzer's list, he would list Will Ospreay and Kyle Fletcher from World's End as the greatest opening match of all time. I'm not going to go that far, but anyway, he has Bret versus Owen, WrestleMania 10. Rey against Kurt Angle from SummerSlam 2002. Darby Allin against MJF from Full Gear. What was that, 2021, I think? Or maybe 2022, which year was it? That Darby, I think it was 2021. And Daniel Bryan against Triple H from WrestleMania 30. Okay, so these are all opening matches to various pay-per-views. And so I have to put one in the main event, one on the pre-show, one is the opening match, and get rid of one. The main event out of all of these is going to be Bret against Owen at WrestleMania 10. So there's your main event. The opening match, I would have... See, this is a very good question. I'm going to have Kurt Angle and Rey Mysterio as my opening match. I just think that's a great way to start the show. The pre-show match, I'm going to have... Man, it's tough. That's tough. You know what, though? I'm gonna have Darby and MJF as the pre-show match, and I'm going to eliminate Daniel Bryan and Triple H. I think that's what I'm going to do. All excellent matches, but if I'm trying to structure this card, I want to hook people in on that pre-show. I'm going to go with Darby and MJF. Good stuff. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Appreciate all of your feedback, all of your questions. I try to get to as many as I can. I do read it all, but we'll try to get to more questions next week. Of course, we are heading into a very busy week. We have our usual live schedule on YouTube, but Monday night's going to be a big one. So join me live after that first Raw on Netflix, and then we have Dynamite and the Casino Gauntlet this Wednesday, and then another 3-hour SmackDown coming up this Friday, where LA Knight is getting his rematch with Shinsuke Nakamura for the United States Championship. And then next Sunday, episode 896 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off, as we grow closer to 900 episodes of this very podcast. So be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Enjoy the show on Monday night. I will see you live on YouTube and back here next Sunday for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off.
Esru, any advice on what to say to a coworker confused Liv Morgan with Alexa Bliss? As far as what to say to your coworker, I would just correct your coworker. They're both blonde. It's not unreasonable to think that somebody who isn't a hardcore diehard fan would get them confused. I wouldn't go too hard on them. People confuse blondes all the time. Take it from me, I get messages every day. Every single white guy in an old wrestling photo. Hey, that looks like Sala Monster. Brian Danielson, a young Brian Danielson. That kind of looks like Sala Monster. Orange Cassidy. That kind of looks like Sala Monster. Jack Swagger. That kind of looks like Sala Monster. There was some Swedish fucking soccer player that somebody tweeted me once. That looks like Sala Monster.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Sala Monster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Sala Monster.
That kind of looks like Sala Monster.